This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 129. I'm a reporter, not a doctor. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Charlene Schmidt. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including Scott Bakula's NCIS spinoff, the Star Trek Continues second episode premiere, Ronald D. Moore on Trek's return to television, the Masterworks edition of Star Trek 2009, plus Commander Riker trying to sell something, and Spock riding a unicorn. Then in the feature, we're joined by Daniel Prue to discuss the Voyager episode, Message in a Bottle. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Char. Welcome back to the Ready Room. It's good to have you hosting news with me this week for our Voyager discussion. And I have to tell you right off the bat, apparently I've relocated to your neck of the woods because we just had the biggest snowfall in Tokyo in 45 years this weekend.
Well, congratulations on all of the snow, because actually we haven't had a whole heck of a lot of snow in Fargo, but we've got a lot of cold going on.
I bet.
The polar vortex, or whatever they're calling it this week. It's making temperatures here even colder than usual for Fargo, which is already pretty darn cold. So it could stop any time now. I'm sick of freezing all day.
Isn't that caused by the El Niño effect?
Every year, it seems, but even more so than usual. So it's lovely. Yes.
All right. Well, you know what Cisco says, if anyone knows how to keep things cold, it's the Breen.
Yes. Yes. And we have a lot of Breen here in Fargo. I'm just not one of them, I guess. I don't know.
I'm just picturing now. I'm going to visit North Dakota. I walk out and everyone is in a suit.
Yeah. Well, you pretty much have to be to survive out here. Yeah.
with your helmet on and everything. So.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yes.
Well, let's jump on into the news today. And enough weather talk. Although we're talking about cold right here, let's talk about getting hot. I have a feeling that our news editor, Mariel, probably fainted when this first news story came across the wire, because apparently Scott Bakula has been cast to star in a new NCIS spinoff set in New Orleans.
Yeah, almost as good as who she refers to as Captain Fine.
Captain Fine.
Yes, right. Which, for those who are not acquainted, that is the Abramsverse, Kirk, Chris Pine. Scott Bakula, on her hierarchy, I think, is just the next best thing, and he's coming back to TV.
Yeah. So this is set in New Orleans, and Bakula is going to be playing Agent Pride, which is, I don't know, it's kind of close, it's short. Agent Pride,
yeah.
And he is a man who embodies New Orleans, according to the press release.
Now, what do you suppose that means?
I think he throws beads at people. He likes to eat really, really large sandwiches. And he loves jazz.
Well, all right.
Apparently, he'll pull his shirt up if you throw stuff at him.
Yeah.
Which Mariel's probably
really
going to try.
Really drunk every night.
Yes.
Hang out on Bourbon Street. Is that what that means?
I don't know.
I've never been to New Orleans.
Well, I have. In fact, I have family there. So, yeah.
Okay, interesting. Well, and apparently this New Orleans office that he's going to be, I don't know, is he heading it up? I'm not entirely sure how much information we have just on this yet, but it's going to be spanning from Florida to Mississippi, and maybe a little bit of Texas as well. So it's not just New Orleans, it's just kind of the headquarters.
That's right, yeah. So we'll see. Yeah, not a whole lot of details on this. other than the pilot will air as part of a two-part NCIS special this spring. So if you are a fan of Scott Bakula, or if you're a fan of NCIS, then keep your eye out on this. I think that, you know, a lot of Star Trek fans and a lot of science fiction fans will be happy to see Scott Bakula back on the screen. You know, I'm personally not an NCIS mm-hmm. fan, but I really like Scott Bakula, not only his acting, his roles on the screen, but just as a person. I mean, he seems like one of the greatest guys in Hollywood, and everyone who's worked with him has said the same thing. So it's really nice to see him back mm-hmm. on television.
Yeah, and I haven't had I haven't heard a whole lot of Scott Bakula news lately, so it's kind of nice to get an update and see that, yes, he is still going to be on the screen. We'll get to see some new stuff with him, and that's awesome. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this, Char. Okay, Scott Bakula coming back to TV is awesome. What about Spock riding a unicorn? Is that awesome? Because this illustration, which is for real, I'm not making this up. We're going to put a link so you can go look at it yourself. This exists, and apparently it was commissioned by Men's Health magazine.
Which, that's the really weird, trippy part. I mean, Spock riding a unicorn is cosmic and groovy enough, but for Men's Health magazine, of all things, Hollywood could not have written that.
I know. I have no idea what they're using this for. I have no idea why they commissioned this piece of artwork, but it's bizarre. So it was,
it
hasn't been published as far as I know. It's an original painting by illustrator Tim O'Brien. And I found the story on Tor.com, the science fiction site, and Tor art director Lauren Panapinto, I'm probably pronouncing that very poorly there, Panapinto, spotted it during a show at the Society of Illustrators in New York City. And it is Spock riding a unicorn with its wings spread wide. It's like this. Do all unicorns have wings, Char?
You know, I'm really honestly not sure, but I do know that they have horns on their heads.
Well, yeah, they have horns on their heads. I feel like I should know this, but I feel like I often see unicorns that are like white horses with the horn on their head. This painting has wings like a Pegasus, wings like a Pegasus as well. And Spock is riding it and going through the air. There's a cloud in the background, and then there's a beautiful rainbow, you know, right at the feet of the unicorn.
Yeah, this reminds me of something that maybe somebody would have made, you know, some fan art in the 1970s or something while on some sort of really awesome drug trip.
Except that it's a really good painting in terms of the quality of the artwork itself and the realism of it.
Yeah, that's just it. It's really good, high quality stuff, and it's got a lot of imagination. It's just, why?
Why?
I cannot answer that question at all. And so, well, I hope we do learn some more about this.
Well, Tor might have an answer for you. Tor asked on their website, do you think he's doing it to get Kirk's attention? Like, Jim, look, I can be your everything.
Yeah. Maybe so. I think there's so many unanswered questions here. I look at it and I don't know where to begin.
Neither do I.
Yeah, but you know what? That's not the only thing that's confusing me this week, Chris. We've got a lot of strange news.
We really do.
This YouTube video that was shared by Stacy Miller, who writes for Trek FM, has Commander Riker trying to sell some kind of crap. I don't know what. It's got to be from the early 1990s. And I don't know why in the world, I don't know why this thing came to be, because it takes place on the Enterprise D bridge. Jonathan Frakes is playing Commander Riker, selling this database software. And I have to think it's like maybe one of three things. Like, one, Paramount owed somebody a favor. Two, Jonathan Frakes made a really bad promise to somebody, and this is the result. Or three, he really needed the paycheck, but that doesn't make any sense, because by this time, I mean, he'd been on the show for several years. He had plenty of money. So yeah. I don't know what gives.
Well, this was made in 1993. The copyright on it is 1993 Paramount Pictures.
Okay.
And it's for a company called Boole and Babbage. And you start into it's 6 minutes and 2 seconds long, but it's a commercial. And yeah. Somehow I had never seen this before. And I just, it starts off, it feels like an episode of ALF. It's like, you know when Willie is at his job and then ALF calls him up on the phone and Willie mm-hmm. has to pretend like he's talking to Brian or somebody or Kate because he's talking to an alien on the phone?
Yeah, that's exactly what this is.
It's what it feels like, right? And it looks like that too because it was shot there in the early 90s. And it takes them more than a minute before you ever get to anything where you have any clue whatsoever what's going on. And then you find out apparently they operate some kind of, they operate the air traffic control in an airport or something. Mm-hmm. Something like that.
Yeah, and some sort of air traffic database, yeah.
And the system's down and it's costing them $50,000 per minute while the system's
yeah.
down. But it's still like a minute and a half, almost 2 minutes into this video. Still all the stuff's going on in the office, and then they cut to this guy, Harold, who works in the office, and he's talking about, this is down, and this system's down, and I've got Star Trek on my screen, and you see the Enterprise go by on yeah. the computer screen on his desk.
Yes, yes.
And then it cuts to Commander Riker.
Big, giant monitors of the day.
Yes.
Oh, it's so bad it's good. You've got to watch it. People listening, once you're done here, go onto YouTube, click our link in the show notes, and it's worth the 6 minutes of your time. You're just going to have your jaw down.
In fact, you may want to bookmark it or get one of those applications that lets you suck videos down from YouTube so you can watch it whenever you want, you know, on your iPod or whatever. There are some classic lines in here, and scary too. Now, Jonathan Frakes, of course, they're on the bridge of the Enterprise D. He is Commander Riker at this point.
Yeah.
And there's that moment where Harold is going like, Barney? And then they cut and he goes, no, Harold, it's not Barney. It's Commander Riker of the Starship Enterprise. And you know, Harold is going like, what the hell?
Yeah. That's what we were all thinking.
That's what Harold. We're all thinking. And then it gets really scary. Riker says, he gives this smile and he goes, I have your entire Enterprise information system cloned.
Yeah.
It's like, I just stole all the data out of your computer and put it into my data banks here on the Enterprise.
Yeah. So apparently Commander Riker is a 20th century hacker.
I think so.
Apparently going into these old databases for the heck of it. I really honestly want to know what this was for, how it was used, and why, because I cannot figure it out.
I know. It feels like a business-to-business marketing piece. I actually do technology marketing. My clients are mostly in technology, and I deal with systems management and kind of the stuff he's talking about here, but I've never thought about creating a six-minute piece that incorporates Commander Riker in, like shoehorning him into this other situation where it makes no sense. And the whole time that you're listening, you're like, who came up with this and what were they thinking? But then Riker, I mean, he does try to make Harold feel better. He says, all of the data required to solve your problem exists somewhere in your system. And that feels like saying, you're like, somewhere in the universe, there's an answer. And that's the Star Trek.
You just have to find it.
So it's really, really bizarre. And you have to go watch it. So as soon as you're done with this, we'll put a link here in the Enhanced podcast. And we'll put it in the show notes as well on the website. But thank you, Stacy, for sharing this. And this is, it's mind-boggling and it's hilarious. And I really don't know what to say about it.
Yeah, it's a really good break in your day. Just sit back and enjoy it and don't take it seriously at all.
One other weird thing. For some reason on YouTube, this is categorized as pets and animals. I don't know why.
I'd like to think that was done on purpose.
I have no idea. All right. Well, let's move.
That's fantastic.
Let's move back into some more legitimate quality Star Trek video.
Have some this week.
We do. Star Trek Continues has premiered the second episode of their series at Dallas this weekend. This is at Dallas Comic Con's Sci-Fi Expo. By the way, my co-host from Literary Treks and the Orb, Matthew Rushing, who frequently comes on the Ready Room as well, he's there this weekend at this very expo, and Star Trek Continues has premiered the second episode called Lolani.
Oh, fantastic. Now, do you know if Matt watched the premiere as it happened, or
I don't know.
Was he busy doing other things?
I haven't talked to him yet. His big event for the expo was getting to actually meet Amy Pond from Doctor Who, and so after meeting her, I don't know, you know, if he passed out. I don't know what happened. If he was lucid enough to go and watch Lolani or not. But the story of Lolani is a survivor from a distressed Tellarite vessel pulls Captain Kirk and his crew into a moral quandary over her sovereignty. And the episode is now available on the Star Trek Continues website, so you can go there and you can watch the whole thing right now. And, of course, our friend Larry Nemechek is in this episode playing Dr. McCoy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And since it's debuted, since it's premiered on our time now, yesterday, I've not had a chance to watch this yet, but I am very much looking forward to it. I'm also excited that this isn't going to be the last we see of Star Trek Continues. They're funded for another 3 episodes. Their Kickstarter campaign just went through the roof.
They did. Their Kickstarter campaign did really, really well. It was like multi-vector assault mode on funding.
Indeed, with the ablative armor and who knows about the shields, but whatever happened was good.
It was good, yeah, yeah. So 3 more episodes there. So looking forward to that. They've been doing a great job. There are lots of great fan series that are being produced right now. It's really amazing what people are doing. Star Trek Continues, definitely doing a fantastic job as well. So go check it out. Again, I haven't watched it either because as we're recording this, it's just premiered and it just became available on the website there. Go check it out.
Yeah, I'm looking
forward. So congratulations to Star Trek Continues on another great premiere. But what I especially want to see, Char, and I know many of our listeners do as well, is I want to see a full-blown CBS Paramount-produced Star Trek series return to television. And apparently Ronald D. Moore does as well.
Yeah, he came out with an interview on Digital Spy and talked about Star Trek on TV quite a bit. And I just like to read the little bit of a quote because I think this sums up what a lot of fans feel, actually. And he says, "I think its home and its heart is really in television. That's what Star Trek is. The core concept is really a TV show." And then he goes on to say some things about the J.J. Abrams verse and how that's great.
Mm-hmm. Positive
but
things.
He does say positive things. But he goes on to say the kinds of stories that you'll tell in the feature space are not the kinds of stories that make the show so popular.
Right.
And that's where the beauty of TV comes in. And he is so, so right. Yeah. I would love to see Star Trek on TV. And I know countless listeners are just saying, yes, 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 right along with us. We discussed this on To the Journey a couple of weeks ago. I don't know how likely it is, but boy, would I love to see it.
Well, I'm pretty sure it's very likely. I mean, I don't even think it's whether it's a question if it's likely or not. I think it's inevitable that there will be another Star Trek series. But
you think so? Okay.
The time frame, of course, we don't know. I would love to see it happen in 2016 because it's the 50th anniversary year. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I mean, you know, the next Abramsverse movie is going to come out in 2016 if everything stays on track. So I could see them maybe releasing that movie in the spring or summer and then a new series launching in autumn because you would, I think ideally you would want to do like Enterprise and have it actually launch in autumn, like a normal TV show would, mm-hmm. whereas Voyager and DS9 yeah. both launched in January. But I don't know. I mean, you know, obviously there are lots of pieces that have to fall in place. Of course, Star Trek has this messy relationship between Paramount and CBS with the film rights and the television rights and, mm-hmm. you know, who gets to do what with the franchise. So I don't know, but I think eventually we're going to get a TV series. I think it's just, it's one of those things where, it's one of those franchises where there's always going to be a hunger for new material. And it all comes down to money. And as soon as a studio sees that they can make money off of it, then it'll happen. Hmm. You know,
I think that's the very problem. I don't see CBS coughing up the money right now to do a 1-hour sci-fi drama, and seeing it on CBS doesn't seem right at all. So no. Where would it go?
Well, I don't think it would be on CBS.
Would it go on
CBS.
Something like Netflix?
Well, maybe. Yeah, maybe. I mean, it's not going to be on CBS. I cannot picture Star Trek being on CBS proper. What I can picture is it being on, say, Netflix or Hulu. You know, Hulu has so many made-for-Hulu series now. And mm-hmm. and when you hear that, you think like, oh, it's kind of like this little thing that they're going to do and put it on Hulu. But these series are really good. I mean, they're as good as anything on network television. In fact, they're often better than what's on network television. Mm-hmm. And I think that they're using Hulu because Hulu is like a joint project of a lot of networks together. And so, and Hulu's been fantastic for distribution because, you know, like I live here in Japan. But we're talking in the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
About New Girl and the episode of New Girl with Prince that came on right after the Super Bowl. But what was interesting to me is that I got to watch it just not long after everyone in the States got to see it. And by not long after, I mean like a few hours, like within one day, because mm-hmm. I watched it on Hulu because they just put it right up there. And I think that this is increasingly the way to distribute shows. And so I can definitely see by the time we get around to a new Star Trek series, I could see CBS producing it, but the distribution would be through Hulu or through Netflix or it's not going to be on CBS. You know, it's not going to come on after How I Met Your Mother.
No, absolutely not. And I really do think that as the bigger networks do find more ways to cash in on the success of things like Netflix and Hulu, maybe we are going to see more of these niche shows going that route. I would love to see it. I really would. I have doubts about it. I don't think it's going to happen by the 50th anniversary, but CBS, I dare you to prove me wrong.
Yeah. I think you're probably right. I think it could be more like 2017, something like that, before we actually see it happen. But I do think it'll happen. So I'm just hanging in there. I'm already thinking, you know, we're going to have another podcast on the network here when it comes out.
So let's start planning now.
It'll be interesting, though, like to do a podcast every week of a new show that's coming on every week.
Right.
And talking about it through new eyes instead of this, the way we analyze these episodes that we've seen mm-hmm. dozens of times. It's going to be really fun to talk about stuff we're seeing for the very first time every
week. Yeah. So. Absolutely. We've not had that luxury yet.
Yeah. As for Ronald D. Moore himself, he's currently the executive producer of Helix, which is a new show on sci-fi. And that's about a team of scientists from the Centers for Disease Control who travel to a high-tech research facility in the Arctic to investigate a possible disease outbreak. So I hope they've got a little bit of Khan's blood with them so they can, you know, make everybody better.
Don't leave home without it.
But if you want to see what he's working on now, you can check out Helix over on Sci-Fi. Okay, we have one more news item here before we wrap up, Char. And this is about Star Trek 2009, speaking of the Abramsverse. And this is coming only to Europe right now, apparently, and it's not even available in the UK, at least on Amazon for pre-order, but it's from Paramount's European Home Entertainment Division. It's called the Masterworks edition of the 2009 film.
Yeah, this is some single disc edition of the 2009 movie, and it's got really nice, like, it's a digibook.
Yeah.
It's got some really nice packaging with it, it looks like, with lots of artwork and photography. But I'm not really sure what to think about this. It's available for €20 for pre-order only in Germany right now. It's supposed to be released April 3rd.
Yeah. I think it's available in a few other countries, although I didn't go to all the stores to check. I did check the UK, and it's not there. I think maybe like France, maybe a few countries. I don't know. You know, it's one of those things. I looked at it, and I thought, oh, okay, 20 euros. You know, like, you know, maybe I'll order it. It's region-free Blu-ray, so you can play it anywhere. But I don't know. I like the concept of it, which is if you've been in the bookstore, and they did this for the 2009 movie, I'm pretty sure the... Well, I know they did. I saw it in the bookstore in Tokyo. Hardcover art book where they like really take you through how they created the art for the show, and it's printed on really nice high-gloss paper. That kind of stuff's really interesting to me, and this feels a little bit like that, but on a smaller scale, of course. But of course, the book has to be the size of the Blu-ray case itself, so it's very small. It's like when I got the Into Darkness steelbook here in Japan, it had the Countdown to Darkness comic included in the steelbook, but it had been squeezed down to a little size that fits inside the Blu-ray case inside the steelbook. And so,
ouch,
that was kind of weird. I think I'd like to see them do something like this, but make it bigger, like do it more like the real art book. But the other thing I would want is that anytime I see single disc edition, you know, it's kind of like when you're selling a house and you say like the house has a large open yard or something like that, which means we didn't bother landscaping it, but you want to play up the fact that it's big, right? You know,
right,
or something like that.
Right.
Whenever I hear single disc edition, I think no special features, right? It's just the movie.
Exactly.
And so it'd be cool if they did something like this and they had like special art focused special features. Something like that to really make it a must-have for people who are interested in the nuts and bolts of putting together the film. Otherwise, here it kind of feels like it's a repackaging of the single disc edition of the movie with this little book thrown in.
Yeah, that's exactly how it feels to me. I mean, if I really wanted to go to the effort to buy this, which I'm not... yeah, I don't know if I'd want to cough up the money anyway, because I already have the movie, and it doesn't seem like you're getting that much more extra stuff. And if I want artwork, I want really high quality, big artwork. So this just doesn't appeal to me, but that's just me.
Yeah. Now, I like the idea of it, though. And wouldn't it be cool to see them go back and do this for the original series movies? And like really do nice art books, behind the scenes stuff that we haven't had before. See, that would be cool.
Okay,
that
yes,
I would buy.
Now that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now that would be cool. And you know that I'm a junkie for extras, so the more behind the scenes stuff, the better. And yeah, I will cough up the money again for the movie I already have for the extra stuff. But yeah, there's got to be something new. There's got to be something really worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. But if you are interested, go check it out. It might be coming to other markets later on. We don't know. But again, it is region free, so you can order it from Amazon in Germany if you want and have it sent to you. And we'll see. And this reminds me, actually, Char, this is not a new story, so we're not going to talk about it long. But these little ship models we've talked about on here before, I noticed they've expanded those to Canada this past week. And they need to put those things in Japan because I want those. I really want
those.
You
want all the memorabilia.
No, the little ships are cool, though. I need those.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. I found, I was in Toys R Us last weekend, and I found this here, classic Colonial Viper from the original Battlestar Galactica. It's Hot Wheels. You never find Battlestar Galactica stuff in Japan, especially not in Toys R Us. This was
so
packaged.
Say we all.
So say we all!
This was packaged for Europe. Somehow it ended up in the Toys R Us here. They only had one. I grabbed it. I looked it up online on Amazon yesterday, and on there it cost twice what I paid for it in Japan. So that was really shocking. Hmm. So give me some ships.
By your command.
All right.
Well, that's all we have in news. We are going to talk about a cool ship in the feature today as we talk about the USS Prometheus in Message in a Bottle. But before we do that, we want to tell you about our sponsor for today's show, and that's Audible.com. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks. With more than 150,000 titles to choose from, they have new titles coming out every week, literally hundreds of new titles coming out every week. I don't know how they do it, and I'm always shocked when I look and see
the
new stuff that's coming up there. You know, I have my credits every month as a member, and I look to see what I'm going to read, and there are so many things I want to download that I have to be really picky about it, but they have a lot of classics. They have a lot of bestsellers, a lot of new releases, lots of Star Trek books as well, lots of science books, which I love. But, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably especially interested in the Star Trek books that they have. And Char, you picked something to recommend today.
I did. For Voyager, there's not as much of a selection as there is just of Star Trek in general. But if you want a recap for Caretaker, listen to the audio version, because there is an adaptation from the Voyager pilot written by L.A. Groff, and it's narrated by Robert Picardo.
Excellent. I like L.A. Groff. They wrote some of my favorite standalone novels in the Invasion series and others as well. So good choice for the novelization there of the episode. And, you know, Robert Picardo reading it, that's brilliant by itself.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can't beat that. He also narrates Pathways, written by Jerry Taylor, which goes into the backstory of the Voyager crew. So if you can't get enough, you can get your dose of Bob Picardo in either one of those audiobooks.
But for some reason, he starts every book by saying, "I'm a doctor, not a narrator."
Well, I think he proves himself wrong, but he's got to go through the whole process of reading the book before he realizes, hey, I am a narrator.
And he is. He's really excellent. So check these out. You can get Caretaker, you can get Pathways, or anything else you want absolutely free as a Trek FM listener. All you need to do is just try out Audible. If you go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up, you can choose any audiobook absolutely free. Try Audible for 30 days. If you decide at the end of that it's not for you and you don't want to stick with it, you still get to keep that free audiobook. So there's absolutely nothing to lose, but you're going to love Audible. If you're listening to podcasts, audiobooks are made for you. You're going to love it. Mm-hmm. I've been downloading audiobooks from Audible for 14 years now. I have a huge collection and I plan to continue doing so for years to come, because I love them so much, and I really appreciate their support of the network and the Ready Room here. And it's another way that you can help us keep the show coming as well and get something great in return. So go check it out again. That's audibletrial.com/trekfm. And thanks so much, Audible. Ever since the Doctor got his hands on a 29th century mobile holo-emitter, he had been itching for some more away mission action, and he finally got his chance to get far away from the ship, and I mean really, really far away, in the fourth season episode, Message in a Bottle. Thanks to Seven's discovery of an abandoned, and I'm doing air quotes here, alien relay network, the crew found a possible link to a Starfleet ship in the Alpha Quadrant, but only the Doctor can make the trip. And waiting for him on the other side of that network was Matthew from News Radio. It sounds like the perfect setup for an episode of Star Trek, right, guys? Well,
yeah, why not?
Today we're going... It does.
It was the 90s. They did crazy things.
Well, today we're going to discuss this humorous Voyager outing, which also served as the setup for a number of far more serious storylines down the road. And to help us do that, we're joined by one of our fellow cohorts from the Alpha Quadrant, from our TNG show, Earl Grey. It's Daniel Prue. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, Chris and Char. I'm super happy to be here. I'm taking a little break from TNG this week to talk some other Star Trek. So I am excited to maybe visit the Delta Quadrant via this network relay stuff going on. So
yes, that is how we have you connected to this meeting.
Right. That's so right. If it crashes or anything, you know, it happens.
Yeah, you're stuck.
Well, you know, let's look at, I'm going to be like Janeway here. Although we're using an abandoned alien network that we just now stumbled across, which is very complex and spans the entire galaxy, I'm going to get really frustrated right off the bat when it doesn't work perfectly for us.
Yeah, I'm going to get really uptight that it doesn't work on the first try.
Right. She's like,
yes.
What the hell?
She does. She literally throws her arms up in the air does. And she's just like, she walks away. I can't deal with this. Chakotay, you figure it out.
That's exactly
what
happened.
I'm going to go get some coffee.
Yeah, I think she'd either had way too much or not nearly enough. I wasn't sure which on this episode because she's really on edge. She's really antsy about this whole thing.
She
like, they're
really
so
is.
Short on time, and she's just, come on, the whole time.
Yeah. Well,
settle
you know,
down.
I mean, it's just an alien network that they just discovered. Why wouldn't it work perfectly?
And, I mean, come on, we've done this before. You know how it's going to go. Just chill, write it out. It'll happen. Deep
also, place. if you could send a message to the final relay and then just send a message out, even to the ship that wasn't directly in range, wouldn't that mean it would get to some ship within a reasonable amount of time, like a day or something? So somebody would get that signal eventually, I would think.
You would think so.
Yeah. Yeah, you would think that somebody would eventually intercept it. Yeah, sure. But Janeway, she's clearly not thinking like that. She's just, this is Starfleet. We've got to get in touch with them now.
You know, the other thing I found interesting about that, just in terms of the way they were thinking, is that B'Elanna tells the Doctor that we're going to send you through and you'll be immediately downloaded into that ship's EMH system. Now, when Voyager launched and was thrown to the Delta Quadrant, this whole EMH thing was really new, and it wasn't common on ships. I know the Enterprise E had it in First Contact, but the Enterprise E came after the Voyager was built. So they're just assuming that there's going to be an EMH system on the other side.
Did they say that even? I don't remember them. I don't even like. I distinctly remember them saying we have to send a holographic data stream for whatever reason, which is better than. Some
but
other data stream.
It's when B'Elanna transfers the Doctor out of sickbay and she's getting ready to send him, she does say, when you get there, you will be downloaded into the EMH system of that ship. Yeah,
that is interesting.
Well, maybe even though it was new, it was at least common enough to where they figured, or at least assumed, that yes, every ship is going to have an EMH.
Or they could assume, like, I've never seen this kind of ship before, so it must be new, so maybe... It's going to happen.
Possible.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll talk about the ship soon here. Before we talk about the ship, the first thing we have to talk about is I'm a news reporter, not a doctor. And that's Andy Dick being in this episode. I remember when this first aired, and I'm a huge fan of news radio. I think it's one of the best written sitcoms ever. And it's a real shame that NBC shifted it around constantly, so you never knew when it was coming on, and not that many people watched it, I think. But this was, you know, Andy Dick was on news radio at this time, and when I found out he's cast on Voyager, I thought, that's weird. But when I found out that he's playing the EMH Mark II, I thought, that's even stranger. And it turns out that he was a friend of Brandon Braga's, and he told Brandon that I'd be interested in being on the show. And so...
Also strange.
They put him in here. And the performance is interesting, to say the least. What did you guys think about Andy Dick on Star Trek?
That sentence right there, I think, kind of sums it up. When I heard way back when this first aired, I thought, Andy Dick on Star Trek, really? How is this going to go? Because I'm sorry, he doesn't seem like the most ideal candidate to go on Star Trek.
Yeah.
And he admits himself, he wasn't the biggest fan, but yeah, apparently he and Brandon Braga, they're buds, and said, hey, I'd love to be on the show. Okay, fine, I can buy that. But if I were a casting director And let's say Andy Dick went into audition for this role, which I'm assuming he didn't, but let's say he did. I don't know if he would be on the short list. He's not somebody I would think of as maybe, oh, I don't know, the most reliable, the easiest to work with on the set. Because anybody who lived in the 90s probably remembers how many problems Andy Dick had with drug addiction, lashing out, just being general crazy. Think Justin Bieber, but a few levels down.
But he wasn't as bad at this point in time, I think. I think a lot of that came after News Radio ended.
That's what I mean, yeah. Few levels down, like just a little unpredictable, but not totally raging, oh my God, crazy yet.
Yeah.
Like you, Chris, I'm a huge News Radio fan. So, I mean, I was never into Voyager when I was younger. It was not until it was much later when I, you know, started getting back into Star Trek that I heard that he had been on an episode. And I was like, oh, gosh, like that could be a disaster. That could be really terrible. But I actually think he fits the role really, really well. I love this episode. I really enjoy it. And I think it actually shows his strength as an actor. I've never seen Andy Dick in anything other than News Radio that I even find him kind of remotely tolerable in. Mm-hmm. And this episode, yes. I just love it. Like I think this shows that he actually can do really good comedy sometimes. Yeah. Besides News Radio, like I said.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Even though I might have maybe not picked this guy, he really does work. He makes this work. I mean, he's got just enough comedy in there to make it fun and entertaining, but he's reined in. You know, he actually fits within the format of the Voyager teleplay. Somehow this happened. It was actually really good. It surprised me how good it was.
And can we buy in continuity that, assuming, we don't know, it's never told to us, but they gave up on Bashir and then found Andy Dick to replace him. Is that what's happening? Or,
well, that came after. So Bashir was supposed to be the long-term medical hologram.
Oh, okay, okay.
And so Andy Dick here, he is the EMH Mark II. And this episode takes place in 2374. So it actually is 3 years after Dr. Bashir, I presume, on DS9.
That much longer after. I'm surprised. Which is, okay.
Well, it's 3 years in universe time. Right. So right. Dr. Bashir, I presume, is 2371, and this is 2374. So it is interesting, and I've never even thought about trying to reconcile the idea of the EMH Mark II and the LMH. And what was the one that you guys came up with on Trek News and Views that time, Shar? Was that the?
Oh, okay. I wasn't on that show, but it was something in lieu of the emergency command hologram.
Yeah, it was the EAH, I think. It was like the emergency arousal hologram, I think. It was.
Yes, that's what it was.
It was about the Doctor and Seven. When he was giving Seven love lessons, yes.
Right. So,
yes. I don't know how that plays into this either, but.
Well, I'm sure that was a callback to one of the more particular things that we found out in this episode, which is that the Doctor has added a certain subroutine to his programming, which made EMH Mark II quite jealous.
And when the Doctor says to him, like, I've even had sexual experience, and the EMH Mark II says, like, how is that even possible? I thought that was Matthew from News Radio speaking there as well.
He gets very excited very, very quickly.
Yes.
You've had sex?
What? Maybe you can download those subroutines into my matrix. And then the Doctor says, we'll see. Maybe.
I'm sorry. I find that very kinky.
Oh, it is. Oh, yeah. Because then you would have to assume that maybe on later on down the road there would be patches or like downloadable content for additional features or whatever. So well, whatever, we don't have to get into that.
I can't do this, guys. I'm sorry I went down this road. I provoked the conversation, well, but you don't want me to go here.
It's not just you, Shar. I mean, Robert Picardo himself, he was concerned that people would pick up on them being bosom buddies on the show. And he said after this episode, and this is serious here, he actually said this, my biggest fear is that when this episode airs, TV Guide will do a little close-up box about it, and it will say something like, Picardo and Dick a treat, or Picardo and Dick inseparable, Picardo and Dick together forever. It seemed to give me a note of caution. However, I didn't follow it, and I did tell the story. So, yeah. He was concerned, too. It's not just us here. It's Robert Picardo himself.
Yeah, you know, when anything is going out to the masses, and you know this, Chris, as a designer, you have to think with a dirty mind, especially when you're copy editing. So I'm sure with performing, yeah, you've got to imagine these sort of things because they can and do happen all the time.
Writing copy, writing headlines especially, you definitely do. I do it all the time. Like, I come up with something and I'll think, okay, well, how can someone take this? Ah, someone's going to think this. I got to change this word. I've got to change the word order. I've got to do something. Yeah. Yes.
You have to know all the words, all the subroutines.
Yes.
All the patches. Yes.
So for me, though, with Andy Dick on here, I think that he works really... I don't buy this portrayal of a medical hologram as being something that Starfleet would actually design to be the emergency medical hologram. But I think it works really well in this episode because Robert Picardo himself is quite funny. The two of them together playing off of each other are really good. Robert Picardo also would pitch jokes to the writers on Voyager, and he pitched jokes to Brannon and he got six of his own jokes into this episode, which I thought was cool because a lot of times, I mean, you hear, like, on the Enterprise Blu-rays, you hear Jolene Blaylock talk about how she would call up to the writers, but she would never get a response to anything. And she felt like, you know, she felt like she was just a warm body there to fill a role, she says. So I like the fact they actually listened to Robert Picardo here because there's some really funny stuff in here. But Andy Dick works really well for this particular episode. And I see it as a reaction to the Mark One, like maybe how the Mark One's different because he's evolved by running all the time. But if you think back to when he was first activated, and I think I'll save those thoughts though for the section when we actually talk about the Doctor himself.
Okay.
Well, let's talk about the Prometheus because this was a really cool ship that had multi-vector assault mode, had holographic projectors on all decks, had the fastest warp engines in the fleet, which they cleverly dodged when the Romulans were talking by never actually saying how fast they were going to go, had super, super powerful phasers, a blade of armor, but apparently piss-poor shields because one shot and 80% of the shields are gone.
Yeah, those weren't installed until Tuesday, apparently.
I guess.
Yeah, but that's not even it's not even inconsistent in the episode itself because the first time that they're attacked when the Romulans are in charge, they don't lose all of their shields within within one shot. Maybe it's just that, you know, the Federation isn't good against its own weapons. I don't know.
Yeah, it's kind of weird.
I guess.
But Chris, you didn't mention the most important feature of the Prometheus, which is the fact that it has 4 nacelles.
Yeah.
I mean, how awesome is that? That is the greatest thing. The more nacelles, just pack them on there. Just throw just a bunch of them on there. It's just wonderful.
Well, that's because it can go faster. It was designed to go faster than anything else in the fleet. And we know, you know, just pack more nacelles. The Enterprise D and All Good Things in the future time space had 3 nacelles and it could go like warp 13. So who knows what this ship can do? I know the Stargazer had 4 nacelles, but it was really old technology. These are new souped up nacelles and there are 4 of them.
So is that right. How you skip over warp 10 is with more nacelles so you don't turn into lizards every time you achieve that?
I think
that?
So. Exactly. Yeah, you need the 2 extra nacelles, the way that it forms the warp bubble. It protects you from lizardhood. That's
okay.
What happens, yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
It's like the mother, you know, the sac protecting the baby, the embryos from disease. It's the way that Spot saved the crew.
Okay.
Yes. it's anti-amphibiotic shielding. That was my best attempt at technobabble, sorry.
That's pretty good.
I like that. That sounds like a kind of torpedo Voyager would build as well as they're trying to find new types of torpedoes to use.
I I've
been wanting to talk about, and this is slightly off topic, so we'll make it real quick. I've been wanting to talk about that video on YouTube where they count all the torpedoes that Voyager used versus how many they actually had. What I find funny is they go through, and it's funny when it appears on the screen and they do the count, and they keep throwing up these new types of torpedoes. And when they got to the warp flare torpedo, I'm like, what the hell is a warp flare torpedo?
They made it up.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
But the Prometheus,
for those who haven't checked that out, go look for that video. It is fantastic.
The Prometheus feels kind of like that fanboy moment, right, where the writers are like, we're going to write the coolest ship we can think of, like all the cool things we want to do with the ship. But at the same time, it also does feel to me like a natural evolution of the technology that Starfleet would be building. Because if you think about it, the Intrepid class has the holographic doctor and the holo emitters in sickbay. And the next natural step would be to put holo emitters all over the ship. If you think about smartphones today, and you know each generation of smartphone comes out, what's the next thing that we get? And you look at like the iPhone 5S has this M7 processor in it that basically just sits there and measures vibrations and everything else that's going on so that the information's available if some application wants to use it. And it's just that kind of thing where you keep the features evolve, and it only makes sense that the next Starship would have holo emitters everywhere so that the doctor could go places, and then you would start having more holograms. And you know, when you get into the literature, you start having these ships that are actually manned by holographic crews, which sounds funny if you're only thinking about the TV show, but if you really stop and think about the technology, I think it's realistic. That's what they would be working on.
And the only problem I would have with that is, do you now then have a holographic Citation Ops?
Yes.
I mean, you have to be consistent all the way through. Or maybe they're the only actual, you know, officers on the ship.
Well, think about the space savings that a holographic Citation Ops would offer. When you have actual real dolphins and whales down there in Citation Ops, you've also got to breed fish for them to eat, you know, or brine or whatever they're going to eat. So you need space for that as well. But if they're holographic dolphins and whales, they don't have to eat.
And in fact, they don't need water. If we had a holographic Commander Flipper on the Prometheus, he could potentially man the con.
That's true.
With his little flippers and hit, you know, all the buttons and stuff.
You know, the little flippers reminds me of when the EMH Mark II tells the story about how he, you know, how he saved the ship. And he starts explaining how he types stuff in to the computer and he like does it in the air over the panel. I can see the little flippers going for that too.
Exactly. And really, I mean, honestly, if you're going to come up with and I haven't read these novels that you're talking about, Chris, but if you're going to come up with a ship of entirely holographic people, why would they not all be holographic dolphins? I mean, at least it would be then visually interesting. So why you could just do that.
I like it. Why not just make the whole ship holographic?
Right. That's the next step. And then we've got holographic drone ships with drone crews, blah, blah, blah. This is the road we're on now.
There is the drone ship that the Romulans use on Enterprise that can use holographic projections to disguise itself as other ships. So
that's true.
There you go. And that was way before this.
Yeah, the holographic conundrum.
Multi-vector assault mode is also something that feels like a natural evolution of the design. But there's so many cool things you can do with it, especially when the ship splits into three parts and it can do, when the Romulan phasers come flying at it, it can do a triple barrel roll to avoid the impact.
So are you going to insert three sound clips there? Just out of curiosity, if they were all three going to do a barrel roll?
I'll do it in three different keys. I really hope so. Yeah, three different octaves. That's what I'll do.
There we go.
And that leads to, you know, Space Olympics, where they have the synchronized events for starships. Yeah,
it is a cool concept, right? And it's obviously an extension of this idea that we have. It starts in well, it was supposed to start in the original series, but didn't. And then it starts in The Next Generation when we see the saucer separation, but it's definitely designed for a different purpose. So, you know, it's not just to get all the non-essential people away from the mm-hmm. battle. It's supposed to be a battleship. It's long range tactical, you know, vessel or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. So it's actually cool that we get to actually see it in action. And every time that it does this separation, like, it starts to kick a lot of ass. It makes a lot mm-hmm. of sense.
Yeah, it enters kick-ass alert and then separates out and just goes gangbusters.
Another change, evolution of what Starfleet's doing, if you notice, on the Voyager itself, the ship, blue alert is used when you're going to land on a planet. But on mm-hmm. the Prometheus, blue alert is used when you're going to split the ship into three pieces and kick someone's ass.
Right, which will henceforth be known as kick-ass mode. And we yes. can't forget that when the Prometheus goes in kick-ass mode, both times I checked to make sure the fog machines activate. So you know that it's truly kick-ass. Right on the bridge, they're just standing there and there's just this fog billowing behind them. So you know it's going down.
I like
it. It's like the computer says multi-vector assault mode. Separation in 3, 2, 1, and then you see the smoke start shooting out of these little holes on the bridge everywhere.
Yeah.
There's no reason for it, but there it is. Yeah, it's pretty yeah. ridiculous.
The pyrotechnics come in only if things are going badly.
Yes. But it doesn't have what the Enterprise-D has in the alternate timeline, where it has the exploding rocks in the floor and the ceiling when it gets hit by weapons fire.
Right. So no Horta, I'm assuming.
No.
No Horta crew members. No. That's true. Yeah. I was going to say, when we first picked this episode, when I rewatched it, I was going to be like, wow, this must have been a really expensive episode to make. Like, there's actually a lot of CG that goes into it. Mm-hmm. And then they have this whole ship that they, you know, it's not a whole ship, but with the bridge and a medical bay that they built for this, obviously. And then I found out that that's actually a redress of the Enterprise E set, which makes sense in hindsight, but they change it so much that it's kind of hard to tell.
But you know, when the doctor sends the EMH2 into the hatch to crawl into the Jeffries tubes, it's just like First Contact when Beverly's making her escape from the Borg in sickbay. That hatch, she crawls right in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah, also, there was a lot of CGI in here. They did the Romulan warbirds here were done as CGI for the very first time for this episode, in fact.
Oh. And okay, I didn't know that.
I felt that, I don't know, what did you think, Daniel, about this, you know, seeing so many warbirds on The Next Generation all the time? I felt like this had a little bit of a video game feel to it.
Yeah, Yeah, you can definitely tell for sure that they didn't use the model, which is okay with me. This is also actually interesting. I looked it up as well. The first time that we see that class of warbird be destroyed by a Federation starship.
Yeah, it is the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Also pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. But I do, and, you know, anytime the Romulans are on screen, and there's three warbirds at once, we don't get to see that very often, except in Deep Space Nine when mm-hmm. there's a bazillion ships, and so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's pretty menacing when we actually see it happen. So
I did not like the fact that they had two Defiant class ships in this episode, because that was supposed to be a special prototype that they had designed and started building it, and it was overpowered and it didn't work, and then the Borg threat kind of calmed down, and so they kind of decided they weren't going to pursue that path as much. And then suddenly, and it's not just Voyager, you see it on Deep Space Nine as well, late in the Dominion War, you start seeing a lot of these Defiant class ships as well showing up in these big battle scenes. And I don't know, it just, you know, throwing all of these ships in it's easy because they have the models and they can throw them in. But sometimes I feel like I would like to see them think a little bit more about how it affects, especially with the Defiant specifically, because it's such a character on Deep Space Nine itself, throwing that in. You also see on Enterprise, you see this Prometheus class ship in the battle in the 26th century. That was interesting too, because at that point the ship would be, it's the battle between the Federation and the Sphere Builders that Daniels mm-hmm. takes Archer in the future, and he sees it. He's on the Enterprise J. At this point, the Prometheus class ship would be like 200 years old, that technology. And we laugh when we see these Miranda class ships flying up next to the Galaxy class or even the Excelsior class ships still being in service. And that's not very long. So I guess they had to pull like every ship they had out of mothballs for that battle with these sphere builders.
Yeah, they must have, because, wow, that's a little dated.
Yeah.
And the one thing I wanted to mention, too, about the Defiant class showing up, aside from that criticism that you have, which I think makes total sense to me, but those warbirds are, like, absurdly massive, and mm-hmm. the Defiant is a tough little ship. So, I mean, like... You know, really, they would like be literally to those things, they would be like mosquitoes flying around. It's like, why, you know, it's true. Kind of pointless to send them into that. And I was like, whatever.
Well, we do see the Defiant, in fact, in First Contact, flying up to the Borg cube. And the scale there is, it's very cool that you see the Defiant going into the Borg cube, but then you see the Enterprise E zoom in, which is so massive next to the Defiant. Of course, the Borg cube is still massive compared to that. Yeah, I don't know. They play around the scale. Now, in terms of can the Defiant take on one of these warbirds? Yeah, I mean, the Defiant could probably take one of them out by itself.
Well, maybe.
With its weapons. Depends on who's at the helm. If Jadzia's there, she's gonna take him out.
If Jadzia's at the helm, then my heart is melted, so all is forgiven.
If Troy's at the helm, she's just gonna crash right into the warbird.
As far as you can. Get out of there.
I just hope there's no planets nearby.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, while we're talking about Romulan warbirds and such, I wanted to talk about the Romulans in this episode a bit, because is it just me, or do these Romulans not really feel like Romulans? They just feel like Voyager generic aliens dressed as Romulans.
Yes, thank you. I had a big problem actually with the Romulans in this episode, because they were not uniquely Romulans. I mean, how many times do we see Romulans on Voyager? Not very often. But they didn't make them special. It was just, oh, okay, you're the alien of the week, and these were very cookie-cutter Romulans. Mm-hmm. Just the typical bad guys. And that really bothered me.
I do have to say, and this might not have been Voyager specifically, but I will say that they did in this episode improve upon the standard Romulan uniform. And this may have been done in Deep Space Nine beforehand. I can't remember, but they definitely reduced the size of the shoulder pads by like 75%. So that's quite all right with me.
That's true. That is good. Yes.
But you know, I understand. I agree with both of you guys where it seems a little cardboardy for the Romulans. Like, this doesn't seem like something the Romulans would be totally cool with doing. They're much more behind the scenes. They probably would have hired someone else to do it or whatever. Like, they wouldn't have just attacked the Federation mm-hmm. in the middle of this war that they're in right now. Like,
yeah,
probably not a good idea.
It just seems a little bit off.
Yeah. Because this, in terms of the Romulans' actions, so in the third act, when they're in the sick bay and we meet the Mark II meets the Mark I doctor the first time, and he tells the doctor that the Romulans, no, the Federation's not at war with the Romulans. The Romulans haven't gotten involved in our fight with the Dominion yet. It's pretty close together. This story is Stardate 51462. In the pale moonlight, where Sisko actually brings the Romulans into the war, that's 51721. So at this point, the Romulans are sitting on the sideline watching the Federation Klingon Alliance fighting against the Dominion, just kind of waiting to see what happens. So it doesn't make any sense that they would be out there trying to hijack this Federation starship so boldly like this.
And Mr. Orb, like you can refresh my memory. At this, they actually have a non-aggressive treaty with the Dominion at that point, or did they ever reach that? I always thought in my mind that that's what they had, the Romulans and the Dominion.
Yeah, that's right. At this point, they do have a non-aggression pact with the Dominion. So they're just sitting on the sideline. So, I don't know. Romulans typically they're calculating, right? You know, they're not the Klingons. They don't go out there and attack. I mean, they did join the Klingons and go, and they did launch that attack on the Dominion, you know, early in DS9 on the Founders before the war kind of broke out. But typically they sit back and they're very calculating. And so, yeah, this storyline is kind of weird. What I took from it was that at this point in Star Trek, especially the connection between TNG and Voyager, because, you know, people are starting to appreciate DS9 more these days as they watch it on Netflix and they get into it. But a lot of people weren't really watching it when it was on. People went straight from TNG right into Voyager. And I feel like for the Voyager audience of the time, the Romulans were the villain of choice to show that this action was taking place in the Alpha Quadrant. And so from that point, I think that's why they chose the Romulans. But when you put it into the bigger storyline of Star Trek as a whole, it feels weird.
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually a really good analysis. It just feels like, I don't know.
The other thing I wondered, and you can tell me, Daniel, as the TNG guy here, is it just that maybe we don't know enough about the Romulans to really feel like they're right or they're not right? Like, if you see Klingons, you know, like, this feels right or this feels wrong. But the Romulans kind of, they show up to kind of harass Picard or, you know, bother people here and there. But this is still before the Romulans are really in the war on DS9. So we haven't had a lot of really Romulan-centric stories. And so maybe we just don't feel the Romulans the way we feel other races.
I don't know. It does feel a bit overly aggressive for the Romulans. I agree with you. They're much more like Machiavellian kind of. Mm-hmm. They're not going to show their hand, and they're not going to force the situation. If they can, like, kind of taking hold of a starship when it's out in deep space, that's like an act of war. And in TNG, there's a very, very, you know, they play that chess game, you know, mostly Picard and Tomalak, but the Romulans and the Federation, they play this chess game where they don't ever, never cross that line. It's usually like, or a give and take, or, hey, you're infringing on us, now we can attack. Like, it's not just overtly, we're going to take over your ship and steal your stuff.
Right. This actually feels a little more like these Romulans are wannabe Klingons in a way. They're being too direct.
They're kind of Kazon. We're going to take over the ship. We're going to steal the ship.
Bad flashbacks. Ugh.
You know, and the thing for me too with the Romulans in this episode is it's not just the action that they're taking, but it's the portrayal of the Romulans by the actors. Like, they just don't feel like Romulans.
No, they really don't. They're too expressive, actually. Romulans, they're very calm in their demeanor, very calculated, very reserved. These are not those types of Romulans.
I know a Romulan miner who doesn't fit quite that mold. by the name. He likes to yell a lot and shout at Spock.
That's true. But that's everything!
No, but I agree. I do agree. You know, in this universe, yes, you're absolutely right. It's much more let things play out as they will, and it's not so just I'm going to torture you and whatever.
I think that's it. I think that's what I was feeling, that they're too expressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sort of, I don't know, it's more like fanfic Romulans in a way, where you have these people who think, oh, this is an epic idea, I can do this, but then they can't write it to proper execution. It kind of feels like that's sort of a mishap.
And it kind of makes sense too, because they just kind of name drop the Tal Shiar in there, just apparently for fun. Like, I don't know why. He's like, now we're changing. Like, this is like completely pointless in the episode. Now we're changing course to give the ship to the Tal Shiar instead of heading to Romulus. It's like, why? Like, why? And nobody says anything.
There is one possible thing here, you know, for anyone who's listening and going, you guys just don't get what's going on at all, do you? The one possibility could be that this guy here, Rakar, he's the Romulan commander, he's carrying out this action without the authority of the Romulan government as the Tal Shiar operation. But he couldn't tell his crew because they might not go along with it. So after they get the ship, he says, oh, by the way, we're going to go give this to my buddies in the Tal Shiar. And that's why they're doing this, when they really should not be stirring up things with the Federation at this point in time. Maybe. I don't think that's what it is, but just if you're looking for a justification, that could be it.
Or and now this is officially headcanon, he is a changeling. He's a shapeshifter. Ooh. And he's just trying to make crazy stuff happen and get people involved. And that's that would be perfect. So that's what I'm going with.
Daniel, you nailed it. Boom. Yeah. That is fantastic.
I like it. Okay. Now it all makes sense.
It does.
Because think about it. Like, yeah, you would bring the Romulans into the war on the side of, because the humans would get mad at the Romulans and then would be like, oh, we're going to attack you too. And then it just brings extra allies in. It's perfect. That's what's going to happen. Headcanon.
Good job, Daniel.
Excellent.
I played off Chris's idea. I'll give him the credit. So.
No. That was not my idea. That was better. I like that. Okay, before we get off of the topic here of the Romulans and the ship, this is really about the ship. I should have brought this up earlier, but there's just one thing. This was on Memory Alpha, and this is what I call my moment of sigh with the trademark. You read something and you're like, really? So if you pay really close attention, you'll notice that on the hull of the ship, the Prometheus is the NX-59650. The problem is that Mike Okuda had used the number NX-74913 for all of the Okudagrams all over the ship, inside the ship, and the dedication plaque, which we actually do see on screen. And maybe when Voyager is remastered in Blu-ray, we'll actually be able to read this as we see the plaque. But he used NX-74913 all over the place. But the effects house didn't get the memo, and they put 59650 on the hull of the ship. Okay, big deal.
Wow.
I don't care, really. It doesn't matter to me. But on Memory Alpha, it says, according to a Star Trek Communicator article, issue 152, the Prometheus was redesignated NX-74913 after stardate 51461, right before the date the Prometheus was hijacked by Romulans. This was probably stated to alleviate the registry confusion mentioned above. But this is what gets me. This is the moment of sigh. If this statement was correct, it would suggest that the crew of the Prometheus modified the interior of the ship to reflect the new registry number before the old one was changed on the hull.
Oh my God.
Really? That's what the crew was? They have nothing better to do than go around the inside of the ship and fix the registry number on everything?
Wow.
Interior decorators
are gonna
love
this.
It's like a job for Neelix, right?
This is why, and I've said this 1,000 times before, this is why we should have holographic registry numbers on the hull. It only makes sense.
Okay,
you know, same thing with the Sao Paulo on Deep Space Nine. Like, you know, make it all holographic. You can change it anytime you want.
Yeah, I guess this is becoming enough of a thing to where they really should consider this.
Would anybody have noticed? But seriously, like, I would never have noticed. Would you have ever even noticed that?
No.
Well, you know, I've noticed recently that with both iTunes and Apple TV, apparently Apple is now able to push little changes to the software or channels that appear on your Apple TV out to you without you running a full actual update. And so Starfleet could do this, like you said, with holographic registry numbers. They could actually push a registry number change out to a ship deployed anywhere in the galaxy automatically, and it would just reconfigure itself right on the hull.
There you go.
Yeah.
To me, that's, you're already giving it too much legitimacy. Like, why would you ever need to actually change the hull registry number? Because it's designated when you're constructing the ship. Like, that should always be. It's not like something else will just come along and have.
Well, picture this, Daniel. Picture this. The Prometheus has an NX designation right now because it's an experimental ship. Now, they have a meeting at Starfleet Command, and they decide that, okay, yeah, I think we're good to go with this. It's not experimental anymore. You just type NCC into a keyboard, well, it'd be a touch panel, of course, and you just hit enter, and suddenly that NX on the hull of the Prometheus, no matter where it is in space, it just changes into NCC. Think of all the paint you would save, and think of all the time it takes to go back to a star base. You know, you gotta pull into dry dock, and they gotta go out there with their little brushes and repaint the hull in their spacesuits.
Yeah, they gotta scrape off the old one.
Yeah,
this is such a foreign concept. This is like kind of blowing my mind right now. Let me ask, and this, I may show my TNG bias here, and if I am, I ask for forgiveness since we have, you know, both the orb and to the journey.
To To the journey!
Represented here. But, even of your own respective ships, I consider myself a pretty big Star Trek fan, but I couldn't name to you any other registry number than 1701. I just don't care. Like, it just doesn't come to my mind. Like, I have no idea. I don't even know what Voyagers or, like, the Defiance begins with. Is it, like, a 7 or like a 9? I don't know. I have no... It's never stated on... Well, I'm sure it's stated on screen, but not often.
I know,
not like
Voyagers.
The Enterprises. Well, that's because you're a super fan. That makes total sense.
I do not commit registry numbers to memory either.
Yeah, it's just like, why would anyone care about this? I just don't care.
It's sort of like the VIN on your vehicle. Do you honestly know that? No.
Of course, Char. It's important. You need to know that.
No.
All right. Well, let's move on to one more topic here, which for some reason we're 48 minutes into our discussion here. We have not yet talked about the Doctor on the ship.
Well, why do we need to talk about that?
We kind of talked about him a little bit. The main thing that's interesting for me where the Doctor is concerned here goes back to Andy Dick playing the EMH2. And I feel like, while I said earlier that I don't feel like Andy Dick's EMH2 is something that Starfleet would actually create and put on ships without personality, I feel like it's a reaction to the EMH-1 where you can see how Starfleet personnel would have said, you know, this guy is a terrible bedside manner. He's grumpy all the time. He's sarcastic. And we really don't like him. Can you do something to make him more likable? And they kind of went overboard and they made the EMH-2 a goofball that kind of lacks confidence and wants to just go hide in the computer when something bad goes on the ship. Mm-hmm. But really, I think what it is here for me more than that is that Andy Dick's portrayal of the EMH2 primarily is to highlight the growth of the EMH1 in the Doctor over the course of 4 years of being active on Voyager, because we really get to see how the Doctor himself has grown into a real person.
Yeah, totally agree. It's actually, I think it's showing us three things. I think it's showing us just how stiff and grumpy the original EMH Mark I was, and how that has evolved into the EMH we know, which is a very, very different person at this point. But then also, I feel like, yes, the EMH2 is a continuation. It is like that knee-jerk reaction, okay, let's do an extreme turnaround. Instead of the grumpy guy, let's do, really just kind of off the wall, wow. And I feel like that was sort of an experiment, and then they realize, okay, we went too far, and then they kind of find the middle ground and go with that a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you. Like, he's definitely, I mean, even Andy Dick, EMH, calls out Robert Picardo. He's like, with the terrible bedside manner, and you know, so it's definitely obviously meant to be a reflection of that, like just to show us, hey, this is the difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That he was in, you know, obviously the EMH was in season 1, that what we get now in season 4. And it's really striking. Like, it's, in to me, the Doctor is one of my favorite characters on Voyager. One of the strongest characters, you know, without a doubt.
Definitely.
It's
just
like, oh, sure.
The fact that he does this, and like literally the whole episode, that whole exchange, like you said, Chris, between EMH and EMH2, is supposed to highlight, like, hey, no, I've grown beyond this. Like, I have this experience. I know that I'm not going to just cower in the corner and deactivate myself, and I'm going to go out there. And he calls out the Macrocosm episode, right?
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
He's like, you know, and the Suter episode. I'm sorry, I'm not good at Voyager episode titles, but you know, when he takes back over the ship and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's like really cool to see like a mini recap of what the Doctor has gone through.
It's like the Doctor says, previously on Voyager. But yeah, I mean, it shows his growth, and it shows that, I like when he tells the EMH2 that one of the things you learn in the real world is, and he says, I'm about as close to a sentient being as a hologram has ever been.
You can leave your ship?
Yeah.
You can even have sex.
That was the point where he really slapped it down, the EMH2, right? Where he says, oh, I can leave my ship. I've got this little mobile hollow emitter, a nifty little piece of 29th century technology. Maybe you've heard of it. It's in your future.
Can we also, just as a quick aside, because you mentioned the hollow emitter, B'Elanna uses the hollow emitter to bring him to stellar cartography. And when they send his signal away, his hollow, or his, hollow emitter just disappears when he does. And I'm like, where did that go? Like, wouldn't it just fall to the floor or something? Because it's a physical object. They're not sending that into right. the relay. It's just something I noticed.
Good point.
And Daniel says he doesn't pay attention to those little details.
Yeah.
That's a physics issue. That's okay. That doesn't matter.
That's different. Well, speaking of B'Elanna, I was very proud of her, just as a side note, for telling Seven off without breaking her nose.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, because I really, at that point, I remember watching in First Run, I did not like Seven because, yeah, she was rude, and I have another word for her that begins with B. She was kind of taken a little bit too far, and I love the fact that B'Elanna, of all people, who can get so, just riled up and angry, very calmly just puts it out there and gives her pointers on how to fix it, and good job, B'Elanna.
Can I respectfully and politely disagree with you, Char?
No.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I think everybody in the whole episode is on point. Everybody, except for two people, which is Neelix, and I guess he's kind of on point because he's just kind of his obnoxious self, he's got rootin' tootin' chili jalapenos or whatever you call it.
Jalapenos. And then Thomas like, huh?
Chili.
Jalapenos?
So I guess he's technically on point, but he's kind of obnoxious. And B'Elanna, who I actually like a lot, generally speaking, but I think is almost unbearable in this episode. Like,
really?
She gets Chakotay to yell at her in this episode, and that's one of the reasons I think Chakotay is on point, because he's like, deal with it yourself, figure it out on your own. I don't have time for this stuff. But no, I like when B'Elanna's like complaining about Seven, and she's like, she's rude and insensitive. She doesn't even know how to say please and thank you. And I'm like, oh my, were you there 3 years ago when it was season one Voyager and you were punching out people? Like, are you aware of who you are and what you
do?
Like,
that's to show the difference, though. Show her growth, that she has overcome this. And now I almost wish B'Elanna could have been kind of a mentor to Seven, but they never went there with the character, because she has learned a lot at this point. No, she isn't. The first thing that happens is she's not going to just knock somebody out when she disagrees with them. She's going to be a lot more rational and a lot more calm about it. But she's still B'Elanna. She's still fiery. She's still got that Klingon in her. And Chakotay still has to tame her.
I think I see what you're saying, Daniel, that because of her Klingon personality, that still comes out. It does seem a little bit hypocritical for her to be lecturing Seven. But I think ultimately it shows the growth of B'Elanna, that, she has learned a lot over the last 4 years, and she's learned how to control herself most of the time. But the beginning highlights that she's not there yet. I mean, the conversation with Chakotay, you can tell that she hasn't reached the finish line in learning how to interact with people, but she's definitely made a lot of progress. And I liked Chakotay's little moment there too, because I like it when Chakotay tells the former Maquis, get over it. You're in Starfleet now. You're a senior officer on the ship. Act like it. Stop acting like a whiny kid because your little ship got, destroyed and you have to live on this one now.
Yeah. And lest we forget, he was very much a part of getting her into that role as chief engineer. So he's got some responsibility in that himself.
Doesn't it also make you wish that they had given Chakotay some kind of actual command responsibilities on the show? We could actually see him, being a real character on the show?
Yeah, sometimes I wish that would have happened.
There are two moments in this episode that I was like, and it's really the two moments that he even really has any lines, but like, I'm kind of impressed with him. Like when he tells B'Elanna, deal with it yourself.
Yeah.
I'm not, this is not what I have to do. You can handle this. You need to learn how to handle this yourself. And then later on, when him and Janeway are talking about letters home, and I'm like, I don't know what it is about this episode, but to me, he seems like maybe he wanted to be there that day or whatever, but he comes across as much more authoritative and caring and interesting of a character, you know, than he usually does. And it's like, I don't know if it was just the writing or what, but I wish it happened more often.
It's that line. I mean, I think Chakotay is a good character. I think they created a good character. I think the problem is that they wanted to make this the first Star Trek series with a female captain, and they didn't want to have someone, they didn't want to have a man in the command structure stepping on the toes of the female captain. And so they just neutered Chakotay from the beginning. They didn't let him do anything. Yeah. He's actually a good character if they let him breathe, but they never do. Luckily in the novels now they let him breathe, but on the show they don't. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's the difference, guys, is he's actually acting like a first officer in this episode as opposed to just moment, about everything else. And it's all because of, Janeway has to be right because it's the first female captain, blah, blah, blah. And, oh, speaking of the novels, the Chakotay in the novels is the Chakotay that I go with, not TV show Chakotay. Because he's that much better. He's a real person in the novels. He actually does things. It's amazing. Yeah, it's really fleshed out. Props to Kirsten Beyer.
A lot like Chakotay, I just want to just bring this up really, really quickly. Even Harry kind of has a victory moment, I think, in this episode when he's just like, you know what? I'm not doing this. You know, learn your stuff. You're not walking over me. Yeah, he did.
It was
amazing. I thought
it was
great.
He told Tommy where to stick it. Look, I tried. It wasn't good enough. Be a big boy, suck it up, and play medic.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, Harry was good in this episode as well. I do like when Harry is loading the new doctor that they're trying to create with information, and he puts in Leonard McCoy's Comparative Alien Physiology, which, as you guys know, it's a really good book, but it's not quite as best-selling as James T. Kirk's Comparative Alien Physiology.
Well, that's because Kirk's book, it has illustrations.
Yes, and it's sold in a different section of the bookstore.
Right. It's next to the Kama Sutra.
Maybe even small videos or GIFs of some kind.
Yeah, excerpts are on Tumblr.
Somebody needs to make the James T. Kirk Comparative Anatomy Tumblr. I think that would be amazing.
Oh, yeah. Get on that Tumblr. I will follow you.
Oh, man.
Only at home, though. It's not safe for work. That's for sure.
Right.
So to wrap up talking about the doctor here, which it's funny, it's probably the shortest part of our conversation, even though it's a doctor episode, but I mean, the main point, it's a fun episode, right? I mean, it's a humorous moment for the doctor. He gets to go on this Obey mission. He gets to save the day. And I think the best moments in terms of character are those conversations that we've talked about with the EMH2 there. I think that Robert Picardo and Andy Dick play brilliantly off of each other in the battle scene. Mm-hmm. And there's the one point where the EMH2 says something just went wrong and the doctor says, what? And he tells him in all the techno babble and the doctor says, in English. And I feel like that's Robert Picardo as the audience commenting on Voyager in general. It's like, just tell me in English what happened.
Right.
I'm just reading it off the screen. That's all it says. I don't know.
Right. It's it's sort of like Beavis and Butthead trying to figure this out, you know? They have no idea how to really do this. They're just going along.
It makes you wonder if every character in Star Trek ever is less technically capable than we think they are, and they're just reading things off the screen.
Right.
Sir, shields are down to 12%, like, and blah, 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 blah. You know, it's like, it's just reading the readout.
It's a teleprompter.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Hit okay to acknowledge.
Yeah, exactly. It's a pop-up window. Like, hey, your shields are going down. Okay.
Right. And then it says, actually really do anything.
And then it has little buttons you can press that says dismiss, remind me in 1 hour, remind me tomorrow.
And you know what? That can kind of make things consistent in the Star Trek universe, because if every time somebody was like, hey, someone's trying to beam off the ship or to steal a shuttlecraft, if they were just like, oh, remind me in 5 minutes, just I'll hit the snooze button. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that's how they get away, because otherwise security seems to be completely ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense.
I like it. Yeah. Makes a lot of sense.
All right. Well, let's talk about one final thing here as we get near the end. And these are the doors that this episode opens to the rest of the series, because when I think of this episode, I think of Andy Dick playing the EOMH. That's what I think of, and I think about that cool ship, the Prometheus. But actually, we meet the Hirogen for the first time in this episode, and it also establishes that lifeline between Starfleet and Voyager, which gives us a number of interesting stories as the final seasons play out as well. So, Char, what did you think about the Hirogen showing up here?
I think it's fantastic because in the next two episodes following this one, they become very important alien characters. And so I think this episode is actually very pivotal on a couple of different fronts. One in the short term because of the next episodes following it, but then also the Hirogen are a very important part of season four. So you've kind of got this set up for that. But then also, big picture-wise, yeah, this is a setup for a lot of things that we see in future seasons, like Pathfinder, for instance. Yeah. And the whole thing, just I think the mentality changes, too. That's what's really so pivotal, is the fact that Starfleet knows Voyager is out there. They know that they're not dead, whereas Voyager knows that Starfleet is now aware that they are out there, and they're going to start looking for them. I think Janeway really nicely sums it up. Suddenly, 60,000 light years seems a lot smaller.
Yeah.
Yeah, that connection, that's just such a huge turning point for the show as a whole. It goes way beyond this episode.
Yeah.
Do we, now, you'll have to forgive me, I haven't watched Voyager in a little bit, but do we ever find the origins of this network out? Like, this is a pretty expansive and impressive piece of technology. Do we ever know where it comes from, or
we know that the Hirogen, it's theirs.
Well, it's theirs, but I'm pretty sure they stole it from somebody, though, didn't they?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I guess we don't know if they built it or not. It's just...
It seems like something that was there, and then they kind of took it over.
Because they show the galaxy map, and it literally, it takes like 50%. It goes down the whole stretch of the galaxy. Yeah. The galaxy. And so I was just curious.
It's like the Iconian gateways or something. It's something that was built a long, long time ago. Or like in Contact, in Carl Sagan's Contact, there's that network of wormholes that go all the way through, you know, all over the galaxy. And no one really knows who built them. They were just, they were there, abandoned.
Right.
Or the mass relays in Mass Effect, which you may not be familiar with, but that's kind of the basis of that series, is that there's these gateways all the way throughout the galaxy. Yeah. Who knows who built them? It's been so many eons. And,
right. You know. Yeah, we know that the Hirogen aren't really in that much of a vast amount of space. So my theory always was just that it's some ancient alien race who is no longer built them, and they took it over.
That's what I think, yeah.
And how awesome was that Seven moment? And she was just like, I just sent a shock, you know, feedback loop or whatever. And Janeway's like, okay, I'm all right with it. That's
I think
fine,
Janeway
whatever.
Was pretty impressed. Job. She can't say so as the captain, but I saw the look on her face. Yeah,
yeah, she approved. You could tell.
Yeah. And as she was thinking, I better be careful what I say to Seven. I'm going to reach in to get my coffee pot out and get shocked.
It was a mild shock. He'll recover.
It didn't look very mild, did it?
He did scream in agony for a minute. Yeah, that's true.
Seven's definition might be a little different from anybody else. Like, he's going to live? Okay, fine. Not just a mild. It's just he can survive it, so it's okay.
Plus, she doesn't really know his physiology or what he's... I mean, he could be made out of metal or something, or I don't know, water. I don't know what would be more susceptible to electricity, but he could totally have just burnt up and exploded.
Oh, come on, Daniel. Don't pretend you don't know this. I know that you play Pokemon all the time. So you know if you've got a water type, you need to attack it with an electric type.
That's my point. It could be super effective and do twice the amount of or 1.5 times the amount of damage that she would have expected.
Right.
And he could have been completely incapacitated, for sure.
Yeah.
And then what? Yeah, then we've got a full-scale war on our hands. Way to go, Seven.
Exactly.
Since it's worked this time, Janeway lets it slide.
Yeah. And B'Elanna was really impressed. I think that's what B'Elanna warmed up to Seven after that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, another turning point.
Yeah. You know, Tiny Ron played that Hirogen, and he also plays the Grand Nagus' servant, the tall servant, Maihardu on DS9, same actor. But you don't recognize him under that helmet, Hirogen gear. But he comes back. The same Hirogen comes back in Hunters.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which was nice to bring the actual same guy back. Apparently,
yes, back when the Hirogen really were big, bad guys.
They were like 9 feet tall, weren't they? Like just massive people.
Yeah.
Like just big men.
They were meant to be really huge guys, but as time went on, they slowly shrank a little bit. Because it's hard to find really tall actors in Hollywood, especially en masse for a whole crew. So they eventually reduced in size a little bit.
That's too bad, because that's interesting, right? Like, we always get this uniform, human-shaped people. Mm-hmm. That's what I liked about the Hirogen, even in the beginning, because I remember, like, Tuvok was, like, 3 feet shorter than him or whatever, like, when they stood up and they were captured. Yeah. That was awesome. That was really cool.
If Voyager had kept going, you know, by season 9, they would have been like Jawas running around.
Ooh, teeny! Yeah.
All right, well, let's wrap up here. We've been going a bit over an hour, so wrap up with final thoughts here. And, Shar, what are your final thoughts on Message in a Bottle? And your rating, of course.
Yes, a rating. Well, I really do like a lot of aspects about this show. I think most people remember it for the comedy, because of Andy Dick and all that. And while that is really good, what really gets me going with this story is the connection between Alpha Quadrant and Voyager, making that connection, and also kind of just showing how life has gone on for them both, you know, without each other. Kind of shows that dichotomy a little bit, and I don't know, I thought that was really nice on top of everything else, and this is definitely up there. I would say it's a must-watch if you are trying to go through Voyager quickly. There's a lot of important moments here, so don't miss it, and I think I would give it 9 additional subroutines.
Ooh, nice rating. What about you, Daniel?
I may drop a bomb here, but this is actually my favorite Voyager episode.
Yeah, you picked this episode today, in fact.
I did, and I was so surprised when you didn't pick it, because I was like, this episode has a little bit of some problems, like plot-wise and story-wise, but I don't care. It's a ride for me. It's like a roller coaster ride. I'm just having fun. And Star Trek tends to do this, like their standalone kind of fun, silly, funny episodes are just that. That's all they are. That's all they matter. It's just a watch and forget it kind of thing. But this is actually super important in Voyager's run. Like there's a big turning point that happens here. And I think that's amazing. Like, I love that we start the episode and we go on this ride, and at the end of the episode, like, it affects me emotionally. Like, I'm like, yeah, at the end, when Janeway gets a little choked up, I'm like, wow, I feel so hopeful and optimistic. And that's kind of the hallmark of Star Trek for me. I love it. And like I said, I think this is the best, not this episode particularly, but we see the characteristic of these characters at the best of what they are, except for a few exceptions. And it's fun. And I kind of wish that maybe Voyager, because Deep Space Nine was very, a lot of people will say it's very dark and there's all this stuff going on. I kind of wish maybe after this point, Voyager adopted maybe a lighter tone. I would have been totally okay with that. Like if it was like the trouble with triples every time, like just for fun, just for kind of a reflection. That's a popular opinion. That's fine. But to me, that's why I love it. So favorite Voyager episode, one of my favorite episodes of Star Trek ever. I'm going to give it 4 out of 4 nacelles.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, I really enjoy this episode as well. It's just fun. Again, having Andy Dick in here, as weird as it is seeing him in Star Trek, I think he and Robert Picardo play so well together. And it's nice to see some comedic moments in the middle of some, serious threats as well. And there's a lot of eye candy in here with the battles. And even if the CGI isn't quite up to snuff for what it will become later on in Star Trek, but, you know, you have to remember when this was made. And, I complained a lot about the Romulans in the discussion today. It doesn't really detract from the episode for me. It would have enhanced the episode maybe if that part of the story had made a little more sense. So I felt like the Doctor was really involved in some kind of serious Alpha Quadrant political intrigue or something like that. But very good episode. And it's nice that there are those setups for future storylines on Voyager as well. We didn't talk much about Tom and Harry's little adventure in sick bay, but I thought it was cute. I thought it went on a little bit too long at times. It's one of those moments in Voyager where you feel like maybe you should get back to the what's going on the Prometheus over there with the Doctor.
That cool ship, of, please.
Instead of this.
So you weren't concerned about rootin' tootin' chili is what you're saying, Chris.
Well, no, actually I do. I did like the Neelix moment. And that's why my rating for this episode is a giant bowl of Rodeo Red's red hot rootin' tootin' chili.
Well, let's be honest. I felt like Neelix was coming off like this was the first time this sort of thing had happened, and he's really apologetic when I felt like he should have been like, oh, no, not again.
Not again.
I'm so sorry.
It cannot possibly be 4 years into his time on the ship, 4 years into his time in the kitchen. This is not the first time that he's made half the crew sick with heartburn. No way.
This is the 11 billionth time he's given the crew heartburn. Now, come on.
Yeah. In fact, I'm pretty sure that Janeway has already issued little, Tums, basically. It's just something you carry on your uniform at all times, a pack of Tums.
Then why are they coming to sickbay?
They want to hang out there, you know. It's just kind of like, it's like when you're
listen
in.
Listen to the doctor sing.
It's like when you're in school, you know, and you want to get out of class and so, oh, I'm not feeling so well. Can I go see the nurse? And, you know, that way you get out of class for a little while. It's like that.
Tom does say pretty quickly, he's like, let me just go replicate you some antacids.
That's
real
right.
Quick.
True.
Which, if the episode were written today, would be Tom's because it would be a product placement in the episode.
It really would.
Would we hear the jingle as well? Like while he was like, you know, computer and acid, they'd be like, tum, 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 tum. Like that's what
yes.
That's what happens when you put the hypo spray on their neck. And yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well, Daniel, thanks so much for joining us today. Before we go, tell everyone where they can find you on the network and around the internets.
Absolutely. You can find us talking about Romulans and a whole bunch of other great stuff on the Next Generation podcast we have here on the network, Earl Grey, with my hosts, Darren Moser and Philip Gilfus. And you can also find me personally on Twitter. My username is OneUpDan. That is the number one, not the word.
Right. Which is, I think, an order, right? You're telling people to one-up you.
No. It's you can try to one up me, as my name will never change, I will always end up as number one.
Okay, so and that makes sense.
Like Riker, basically. All right. Number one.
All right. Well, thanks again, Daniel.
Thank you, guys.
Well, Chris, as always, I had a wonderful time talking with you and Daniel about a Voyager episode. This time, Message in a Bottle, and Andy Dick, of course. Because, yeah, you just can't say that name enough.
No. Oh, it's hard for me, you know, after watching the Comedy Central roast of William Shatner, it's hard for me to go back and watch Andy Dick, though, in things like Message in a Bottle or on news radio, because in that roast, he's just so, like, drunk. I don't know what... I'm going to say he was drunk. I don't know what else was going on. You know, I mean, everybody
we don't know what he was on.
But man, he is over the top. And if you're listening to this and you've never seen the Comedy Central roast of William Shatner, you absolutely have to go watch that. Not only for Andy Dick, but for Nichelle Nichols, for Betty White, for everyone else that's in there. It's one of their best roasts ever.
The whole thing is fantastic.
It's fantastic. So, yeah.
It is.
Well, yeah, Char, it was great fun, and I'm glad Daniel was able to join us as well. But it's not the only thing we've been talking about on the network this week. So here are some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Hal Sutherland and the Animated Series.
I don't like the animated series. It's not good. However...
See, that's the kind of stuff that makes me forget about it. Would you rather me watch Deep Space Nine or the animated series?
Okay, but now that you're done...
We made that choice.
Now that you're done with Deep Space Nine, you can move on to the animated series.
Earl Grey.
TNG Reboot.
I have a lot of problems with this concept of let's just do the next generation. I don't think it's possible. To me, a big part of Star Trek is like this aspect of exploration and finding out the unknown and going out places we've never been.
The Ready Room.
The Wire.
He's basically becoming a good Federation citizen, and that's causing a huge amount of conflict. And maybe even before he was here, that's what got him here, is that his inner ideals made him a bad Cardassian.
The Orb.
Esri Dax.
Which to me, she really seems like, you know, that boy or girl now who's gotten out of college, is living at home again, and not really sure what they want to do with their life because nothing's turning out the way they thought it was going to. Which is funny because her character is actually more relevant now than it was then.
To the journey!
Voyager Season 3 Marathon.
Being a child of the 90s, and I hadn't watched this in a while, I realized, oh my gosh, how things had changed and how things hadn't changed. Rainn Robbins's gigantic cell phone with the huge antenna and her hippie van, the lava lamp. I mean, I just loved it all. It was very groovy.
Warp 5.
Enterprise Season 5.
Well, they could find, I mean, more excitement in the decon chamber with this whole trip Trantipole love triangle thing for sure.
Yeah, an Andorian fight scene in the decon chamber. Think about it.
Wow.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Robert Hewitt Wolf, Andromeda.
I suppose the easiest way to describe them would be a bat, who lead living hosts for their young.
They're kind of like I'm going to say xenomorphs in Alien, even though Max would kill me for saying that.
Yes, and I dare say he will when he listens.
Literary Treks.
Protectors with Kirsten Viner.
Again, it's just you look at realistically as you possibly can, you know, coming that close to death, being in the two continuum, I mean, what's that going to do to someone? And I struggled for a long time figuring out how to have her, again, realistically work through all of those things.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and get your daily Trek Talk fix. We do have new shows for you every day of the week, and some days we even have two shows, because that's just how much we like to talk, apparently. And you can find them in a lot
of
places, including on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune, or you can download or stream from the website. So just hop over, grab the show of your choice, and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. And Char, some people have got to have comments on what we talked about today. We had so much fun and we touched on everything, even holographic cetacean ops, which is something that I hadn't even thought about. That's why we have Daniel on. You know, we need that.
That's right.
TNG
it's very
perspective
important
on that.
To Earl Grey
yes.
to champion that cause.
Very much. I'm surprised he didn't bring up a holographic Livingston, in fact.
Well, maybe next time.
Maybe next time. All right. But if you do have thoughts on anything we talked about today, maybe Spock riding a unicorn, which original series cast member would you like to see riding a unicorn? You can let us know by going to our website at trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, and that will come to us by email. You can also send us a voicemail through the website, or you can go to our forums at trek.fm/forums to talk to us and other listeners about the show and about anything Star Trek that you want to discuss. And then in social media, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and you'll find us on Twitter under username Trek FM, where we're tweeting away all the time about Star Trek. Now, Char, when you're not, cooking up a bowl of spicy chili just like Neelix and trying to give your husband heartburn, where can people find you?
You can find me usually jabbering away on the Twitter, and my username is Oh the Profanity.
Excellent. And don't you do a little something on the network as well?
Oh, yeah, very once in a while, like, I don't know, once a week, usually every Thursday. Tristan Riddell and I release a little show called To the Journey.
To the Journey.
Sorry to put you on the spot there. I know it's weird with just one.
I'm always ready. Yes.
This is true. Yeah. We do a show every week about Voyager. So if you like this discussion, give us a shot if you haven't already. And we discuss anything and everything having to do with this series.
I'm waiting for that chilly episode about Neelix.
What does he call them? Jalapenos?
Jalapenos. Yes.
Jalapenos. Jalapenos. Yes. Okay. Yes.
Next time I'll use a few less jalapenos.
Jalapenos.
All right. Excellent. Yeah, definitely check out To The Journey. If you'd like to find me, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere on social media under that same username and on my personal website at cbrianjones.com. And then elsewhere on the network, you'll find me, as I mentioned in news today, actually, with Matthew Rushing on Literary Treks, where we talk Star Trek books and comics and interview authors. And in fact, Voyager fans, you need to go listen to Literary Treks this week because we had none other than Kirsten Beyer on with us for a really long discussion about her new Voyager novel, Protectors. And, you know, she is really doing a number on Janeway in that book. And I'm glad to see it because it really, I like the angle she's taking on it. Char, real quick, you've been reading Protectors. What do you think about it so far?
I absolutely love it. It is a fantastic story. I'm not completely through with it yet because I have not read through it nearly as fast as I thought I would because I just have not made much time. My work weeks have been getting crazy lately, but it is such a good book. I absolutely love what Kirsten Beyer has not only done with the Voyager series and the novels, but the characters, the life that she brings, all of the characters is absolutely astounding. Including those that you may have not actually liked on the show. Like, I think Chakotay gets a lot of flack. Ensign Kim gets a lot of flack. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? Lieutenant Kim in the novels, yes, he does get promoted.
Yep.
He's fantastic. He's a real person, somebody that you relate to, that's likable. Chakotay, way more substance. She does an amazing job. And definitely check out the interview because I've really enjoyed that, too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always fun to talk to Kirsten. And you know, the way I summed up her take on Voyager is that it's the potential of the series realized. That's what it is to me. Because she does she does with Voyager what I think so many fans wanted to see happen on the screen. So go check it out. Again, that's Literary Treks. That's episode 49. It's called Deconstructing Kathy. And you can
love
you can
the title, that. By the way.
That was Matthew. Spoke that during the show.
Yes, and it's very true. I'm right in the middle of that right now, as a matter of fact.
It is very true. Besides Literary Treks, Matthew and I also do The Orb together, where we talk exclusively about Deep Space Nine. And then you can find me on Warp 5, where we talk exclusively about Enterprise. I'm on that show with various different people who come on. Tyler Johnson's been on with me a lot of weeks recently, so you can hear us talk about Enterprise there. And then I have my own interview show, MatterStream, where I talk to writers and actors and designers and all sorts of people and scientists as well about topics that are loosely related or inspired by Star Trek. So check that out too. Also, before we let you go, we'd like to remind you about our sponsor today. That's Audible.com, the best source you'll find anywhere for audiobooks. More than 150,000 titles are waiting for you, new titles coming every week. As Char mentioned, you can get the novelization of Caretaker absolutely free. You can get Pathways by Jerry Taylor as well, absolutely free if you want to get that one. All you have to do is give Audible a try. Go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Choose that audiobook. If you decide not to stick with Audible at the end of 30 days, that book is yours to keep, so there's nothing to lose. And by trying out Audible, you'll be helping us bring the Ready Room to you every week. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm. And we really thank Audible for their support of the network. Another thing you can do to help us keep the Ready Room coming is to make a donation to the network. Now, of course, the podcasts are free to all of you, but they're not free for us to produce. And your donations help us pay for the cost of production, hosting, and bandwidth that's needed to bring the shows to you every week. If you go over to trek.fm/donate, we have different levels of contribution for you to choose from. And as a thank you for your contributions, we have original alien illustrations by Tobu Ushi, who does most of the artwork that you see on our website. You can choose if you want them as badges or if you want them as art prints, and you can mix and match. So go check them out, trek.fm/donate, and we really thank you for helping us keep the network going. All right, Char, I'm going to wander back down and check on Tom and Harry and see how their little project to create a new doctor is going. Also, I want to find out if they've got a copy of Kirk's Guide to Alien Physiology on hand.
That sounds like a fantastic idea there, Chris. Well, you know what? I think it's time to stick a third of the Prometheus in it, because this ready room is done.